Thank everyone for coming. Tonight and tomorrow on the Jewish calendar is obviously an extremely significant date which we celebrate, commemorate. And the challenge is that although we obviously all intellectually recognize the significance of Yom HaTzimut, first time in almost 2,000 years that Jewish people are sovereign over Eretz Yisrael, the challenge, though, that I think is really the most critical one each and every year at this time is whether we are capable of not just recognizing that intellectually, but really feeling it viscerally and feeling the emotion, trying to recreate the simcha, the euphoria, the incredible joy that Jews at that time, only 61 years ago, we're able to experience, because it's that emotion, that euphoria, that really is what leads us to the Shevach V'Hodah that we really should be giving to HaKadosh Baruch Hu tonight and tomorrow. And a dry intellectual appreciation of what tonight and tomorrow is all about is certainly critical, but it's not going to, in most cases, give us that drive to offer the Shevach V'Hodah that we need to be offering with the proper amount of energy and passion and true sense of simcha that we need to be experiencing. And that really is the critical challenge, to try and recreate that emotional experience. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, in one of his Sichot for Yom HaTzimut, points out that if we look at the Yom Tov of Pesach, which is obviously Min HaTorah, a Yom Tov which commemorates and celebrates an incredible Yeshua, salvation, Geula, redemption, he says, look at how Chazal told us, Chayavadam Liros es Atzmo Kilehu Yatzam in Mitzrayim. And we have to not just appreciate intellectually, but relive emotionally the Geula and Yetzias Mitzrayim, because that's the only way we'll be able to accomplish fully the experience of giving Shevach V'Hodah properly in the Hal that we recite on Yom Tov HaPesach. And the truth is that although Yom HaTzimut is not obviously Min HaTorah, it's not Midrabanan, it's a much more recent innovation, but the chiv to give Shevach V'Hodah to HaKadosh Baruch Hu is very much the same. And that also, therefore, can only be accomplished if we're capable of trying to re-experience the emotion of recapturing that same joy that once was. I thought the same thing can be seen with regard to Purim and Chanukah. Purim and Chanukah also, not Midaraisa, the Midrabanan, but they were also instituted to enable us to commemorate and celebrate a tremendous Yeshua for Klal Yisrael, miraculous salvation from persecution, from threat of extinction. And there as well, the bracha that we say in both Purim and Chanukah, She'asa Nisim La'avoseinu, we thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for performing the miracles for our fathers, Bayomim Ahem, Bazman Hazeh, in those days, and also today. And there apparently as well, the intention of Chazal in establishing the Nusach HaBracha in that way was to indicate to us that on a day like Chanukah, on a day like Purim, when we're giving Shevach V'Hodah to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for the Nisim that once were, it's not enough to just think back to the past, but we have to take that forward to the present and use that experience that once occurred to give Shevach V'Hodah to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for what's happening today as well. And the very same principle can be applied tonight and tomorrow to Yom HaTzimut. It's not simply that we're looking tonight and tomorrow at what once was and giving Shevach V'Hodah just for that. Even if we are capable of reliving that joy and reliving that simcha, and feeling that emotion and giving Shevach V'Hodah for what happened then, it doesn't end there. The goal of tonight and tomorrow is to re-experience that simcha, but to give Shevach V'Hodah not just for what happened then, but to give Shevach V'Hodah for what we still have today, for that ongoing gift that unfortunately those of us born more recently take for granted, because this is all we've known since we've come of age. But the goal of tonight and tomorrow is to appreciate the Nisim that occurred, and to give Shevach V'Hodah to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, not just for then, but for now and an ongoing way, every day of the year. It shouldn't just end with tonight and tomorrow, it should be an ongoing sense of Shevach V'Hodah to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And just by way of example, Rabbi Lam, in an article that he published in his books, writes that history learned is not history lived. You know, we, the younger generation, are learning history, but we have to try to bring it as much as possible to living history, because the feelings are not the same. And in an attempt to just to try to recapture a little bit the chashivus, the significance of what we're celebrating, I think it's worthwhile to pause for a moment just to reflect on, you know, what the background and the historical backdrop to Yom HaTzmaut was. And the truth is that, just for looking at Chazal tell us that Kedusha Shnia Kitchela Shaita V'Kitchela Asad Lavo, that when Ezra HaSofer came back before the rebuilding of the second Beis HaMikdash with numerous Jews from Golos Bavel, Paros and Madai, they came back to Eretz Yisrael to rebuild the second Beis HaMikdash. So the Gemara says that when they re-entered Eretz Yisrael and took it back, so to speak, resettled it, built it back up, that Kedusha, that sanctification of Eretz Yisrael, was not just a temporary sanctification of Eretz Yisrael. It wasn't just Kidsha L'Shaita, but Kedusha Shniyah, that second re-sanctification of Eretz Yisrael, was Kidsha L'Shaita. It was for that time and La'asad Lavo. It remained in effect, which, strictly speaking, means that the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael is still there today, dating back to that second, pre-second temple era when Ezra Sofer went back and resettled and rebuilt Eretz Yisrael. The Rav Zatzal of Soloveitchik, though, explained that there's more to it than just that. When Chazal tell us that Kedusha Shnia Kitchel Ashaita V'Kitchel Asad Lavo, that the second sanctification of Eretz Yisrael wasn't just for then, but it was for all time to come, what that also means is that each and every Jew, therefore, and from that point on, has had and continues to have, an eternal connection with Eretz Yisrael. Because the Kedusha that Ezra Sofer imbued Eretz Yisrael with never dissipated, it remained in effect. As a result, every single Jew throughout the past 2,000 years or so, wherever he or she might be living, feels very viscerally that deep connection to that Kedushas Eretz Yisrael. And that is something which has never been lost. And the truth is, if you look at the keynotes, for example, in Tisha B'Av, just pick a couple of the keynotes, Rabbi Yehuda Levi, Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Moshe Adarshan, two of the Rishonim who were penning poems that were later used in the Kinos liturgy, and you read the imagery that they describe in their poems describing their Ava for Eretz Yisrael. So, for example, Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Moshe Adarshan writes, "Libi ya'avel l'chabek bizraos." My heart yearns to just hug, to embrace with my arms afar artzeich, the dirt, the soil of Eretz Yisrael. I'm so desperately desiring to kiss with my mouth the stones, the rocks of Eretz Yisrael. Rabbi Yehuda Levi, who writes, "Epol la'api al artzeich, alei artzeich," that I just want to fall face down upon the soil of Eretz Yisrael. And these descriptions of their intense ahava for Eretz Yisrael, which are so vivid in image and so real to them, are just, I think, an indication at the tip of the iceberg as to how intense people's ahava and yearning for Eretz Yisrael was. Another example, the Rav Zatzal described how in Europe as a young boy, you know, Eretz Yisrael, to many people, he said, the simple Jews living, you know, in the little shtetl here, the shtetl over there, people didn't know Eretz Yisrael like we know it today. We've been there, we've visited, we've toured it, we've seen the maps, we've seen the people, we've seen the sites. They didn't have that opportunity. To them, Eretz Yisrael was this dream, this magnificent place somewhere, you know, across the ocean that they just couldn't, you know, it was a dream to see it, a dream to think of it, a dream to imagine it coming back to reality. They never saw it. Then he describes so beautifully how, as a little cheder boy, he said at one point, one day in cheder, they're sitting with their Rebbe. His name, he writes, was Reb Baruch Yaakov, that was the name of his Lamed, Lubavitch HaChassid, and in walks to the cheder room a Yid from Eretz Yisrael, wearing a long kapata. The Rav remembers him as having a red handkerchief in his back pocket. And immediately the learning stopped, and his Rebbe was like so fascinated. He read from Eretz Yisrael, tell us some stories from Eretz Yisrael, like the legends that he would bring with him were so enticing. And then the Rebbe tells the boys to go outside, and the boys step outside, but they're listening by the door, and they hear the Rebbe saying, "Are you really from Eretz Yisrael? Are you really, really from Eretz Yisrael?" And he's like, "Yeah, really, really am." He said, "Have you really touched the Kol Samarafi with your hands?" He said, "Yeah, I've been there, I've touched it." He said, his Rebbe grabbed his hands and he kissed his hands, this visitor's hands. It was the love, the fascination with, wow, a Jew from Eretz Yisrael, a Jew who touched the Kol Samarafi, which we take so much for granted, but for Jews living in Europe for so long, it was a dream that was unimaginable. When they saw somebody who had lived it, they couldn't resist. Such was the ava of a Jew for Eretz Yisrael throughout the Golos, an eternal attachment to the Kedushas HaAretz. And the Rav describes as well a different occasion, how when in 1935 he visited Eretz Yisrael, he said he was in Ramat Gan visiting Rav Zev Gold, who was one of the leaders of World Mizrahi. And Rav Zev Gold, it was a beautiful night, clear skies, bright moon, stars, Ramat Gan, beautiful day, beautiful evening. And Rav Zev Gold, he says to Rav and says to him, anybody who doesn't see the Kedusha, the Shechina, the beauty of Eretz Yisrael on a night like this must be blind. And just in excitement, he picks up a rock and he gives it a kiss. There's even more contemporary people who are so taken with the Ahava of Eretz Yisrael and literally lived it in every which way. There's a woman in our shul, Karen Medwick, Matt Medwick's wife, whose family comes from Yemen. And she told us how after Hakamas HaMadina, when the offer was extended to the Jews of Yemen to come to Eretz Yisrael, so her grandfather, you know, living in Yemen, Jews there were for centuries so isolated, you know, Eretz Yisrael to them was certainly nothing more than a dream. And this opportunity arose, so her grandfather was so excited and eager to find out, is it doable? Can we really do it? Is it really true? Can we take the family? There's a place to go. Is it possible? She said he traveled from Yemen to Israel by foot. Her grandfather walked from Yemen through Saudi Arabia to Israel just to see, is it really true? Is there a place that we can go? Is there a city we can live in? Are there Jews that we can live with? He walked by foot from Yemen through Saudi Arabia to Israel and then back again. All that to tell his family, okay, now we can go. Let's go. Can you imagine? People were so, you know, so focused on Shivas Tzion and going back to Eretz Yisrael that you would walk, I don't know how many hundreds of miles by foot and how long it took him to get there, but such as an ahava for Eretz Yisrael, that's what it brings out in a Jew. Unbelievable story. And I think that, you know, to foster this ahavas Eretz Yisrael, I think that the more, obviously, if one travels to Eretz Yisrael, goes to visit in Eretz Yisrael, that certainly is the first step. But the more we read up about the Nisim that brought us back to Eretz Yisrael, the more we read such stories of Ahavas Eretz Yisrael, of the simple Jews throughout Golus, the more we focus on it, think about it, the more we're hopefully able to excite ourselves to bring ourselves a little bit closer to that ideal, to that goal of Ahavas Eretz Yisrael. I was driving this morning to YU with Rabbi Beryl Rosenzweig of Kew Gardens. So I said to him, I said, I'm trying to just recapture somehow the, you know, the experience of the moment. I wasn't there in 1948. I wasn't around yet. I said, can you share any memories of me, what it was like? You know, what was the simcha like? What was it all about? And he said, he'll never forget it. He said he was a student at Yeshiva University in 1948. Independence was declared on Friday, on an Erev Shabbos, May 14th, 1948. He said everyone knew it was coming because the partition vote that had been approved by the United Nations, that was way back in November already. In November, I think it was 29th of 1947, the UN approved the partition plan. They approved the by a two-thirds majority vote to give the Jews a state in Eretz Yisrael. And from November until May, everyone knew that it was just a matter of time until there was a formal declaration of independence. So he said, he described to me how the boys in the dorm in YU, for all day Friday, they were all sitting in their rooms, they all had their radios on, no TVs then in the dorms. All had their radios on. And he said they were all just waiting, sitting by the radios for just hours waiting because they knew it was coming. And he said the most amazing thing was that as soon as the announcement came over the radio, you know, the announcement of Hakamas HaMadinas Yisrael, he said it was incredible how spontaneously every kid in the dorm, in every floor, in every room, they all started singing out in the halls. Entire yeshiva together. Because the simcha was just so, it just burst out. It was so spontaneous that everyone joined in, same idea, same time, to just sing together in the halls of the dormitory. If you read Rav Amital of Gush Etzion's recollections as well, and his sikhot as well, he recalls in the streets, the singing and dancing in the streets of Yerushalayim when the announcement was made. And you know, when I asked him, well, what was the simcha due to? What was it all about? What did it stem from? So there were two points that he mentions. The first, which is also one that Rabbi Lam in his article speaks about, is that for a Jew who lived during the years of the Holocaust, as Rabbi Lam writes, a Jew in America who listened to Father Coughlin's anti-Semitic ravings on the radio, or a Jew who read Ford's anti-Semitic diatribe against the Jews, or a Jew who listened to Hitler's mad ravings on the radio, and a Jew who then spoke to the refugees that came over from Europe after the war and listened with horror to the stories that they brought back with them from Europe. And for anyone who read about or heard about the hundreds of thousands of just displaced refugees after the war who went back to their homes, found their homes occupied by their local neighbors, all of their furniture and stolen, being used by somebody else, still hated, still rejected, no place to go, no country wanted them, hundreds of thousands of Jews just languishing in refugee camps with no home, no family, nothing. And all of a sudden comes Hakamas Medinas Yisrael, where for the first time these hundreds of thousands of Jews, some of whom had already been turned away by the British trying to get into Palestine, sent to prisons in Cyprus before the Hakamas Medina, and all of a sudden for the first time, now they had a place to go, a place where they could find shelter, safe haven, a place that welcomed them with open arms. So, of course, that was an incredible, incredible cause for celebration. As Rabbi Lam writes, he says, anyone who did not stare the angel of death in the face cannot fully appreciate the revival of life. That's what these Jews experienced coming out of the Holocaust. When they heard the news of Hakamas Medinas Yisrael. And the truth is, Rosalie even pointed me to a beautiful medrash. Yalkut Shimoni in Tehillim. On the kapitel we say every day in davening, Ya'ancha Hashem b'yom tzara. God will answer us, will answer you on a day of distress. So the medrash says, Amar Rabbi Yudon, Moshe l'mah ha'davar domeh. What is this comparable to? There it is. The Medrash says, Dover Acher, Yan Hashem b'yom tzara, Moshe l'mah ha'davar domeh. What is this comparable to? This is in Simon Tov Reish Pei in the Yalkut Shimoni Tehillim. And the Yalkut Shimoni says, La'avu bein shahayu mahalchim b'derech. A father and son traveling together. Nisyagei ha'bein. The son becomes very tired. He's exhausted. Amar la'avu, he says to his father, Abba heichan hi ha'medina. Father, where is the Medina? Their destination. Amar lo, his father says to him, Bini, my son, simen ze yehei biyadcha. This is the way you'll know that the Medina is nearby. Im ra'isa beis ha'kavaras lefanecha. If you see a cemetery before you, Hari Hamadina Krovalach, that means the Medina is very close by as well. And the Medrash says, Kacha Navi Omer Li Yisrael, this is what the Navi tells Klal Yisrael, Im Ra'isa Hatzaros Sheyechasu Eschem. When you see yourselves overwhelmed by suffering, Miyara Tem Nigalim, then you know immediately that Geula is nearby. Shenemra Yancha Hashem B'yom Tzara Yisagev Hashem Elokei Yaakov. Incredible medrash. When Klal Yisrael is overwhelmed by suffering, by a Beis HaKvaros, then you know that a Medina, protective shelter, is nearby, is soon to follow. And certainly for Klal Yisrael at that time, having just been through the Beis HaKvaros and more, the relief at seeing firsthand the Medina that was soon to follow shortly thereafter was a simcha beyond description. That obviously was one critical component of the simcha that accompanied the Hakamas Medinas Yisrael. This understanding that after the Beis HaKvaros, the Geula is krova. But secondly, it was the fact that so many Jews were so involved for so many years in looking forward to this Malchus Yisrael and Medinas Yisrael. Rosenzweig described how, you know, the boys would be participating in demonstrations in Madison Square Garden, New York, and Maple Leaf Gardens in Toronto. People were so actively involved in trying to move the process along in any way they could. There was such an excitement building up in every Jewish heart that to see it come to fruition was such a thrill. I think to really heighten the sense of simcha and appreciation, we need to, just for a moment, stop to pause and think about the nisim v'neflos that brought about this dream, this fulfillment of a dream. And you know, the more you read about it in the history books, the more incredulous you become. So, for example, Martin Gilbert, the British historian, in his History of Israel, writes that in the months preceding the UN vote on partition in 1947, the UN set up a preliminary committee to investigate the viability of a partition plan. Jewish state, Arab state, is it viable? Before we vote on it, we have to make sure it's, you know, a workable plan. And so he describes how members of this UN commission met with leaders of the Haganah in Eretz Yisrael, and they asked them, they said, you know, we know that there's bound to be skirmishes, military battles, fights between the Jews and the Arabs following a partition plan, if there is a partition plan. You know, we want to be sure that a Jewish state will be viable militarily. And so they asked the leaders of the Haganah, how many heavy artillery pieces do you have currently? And the response they got was, we can't disclose that for security reasons. Which the historian writes, translated meant, we don't have even one, but we're not going to tell you that. And then he proceeds to describe how in April 1947, just 1 year before the Hakamas HaMedina, an internal accounting of the Haganah, of what they had at their disposal to fight the inevitable war, determined that they had a sum total of about 10,073 rifles. 10,000 rifles. Then they had under 200 machine guns and a similar number of submachine guns. So you're talking about just how many soldiers they could arm with simple guns. 12,000 soldiers could be armed with guns. That's all they were able to put together. And they're poised to fight the combined armies of every Arab country on their border. With 12,000 guns at their disposal, it's laughable. The heaviest artillery pieces they had were these 2 or 3 inch wide mortar shells. Now, if you're fighting a war for your survival, it's not going to get you too far. They were so desperate, Martin Gilbert writes, that when the Egyptian Air Force bombed the one airfield that the Jews had in Tel Aviv on the day of the Declaration of Independence, and they immediately destroyed whatever planes they had there, the Haganah was so desperate that they actually reassembled the planes that had just been destroyed, piece by piece. Can you imagine that? You know, an enemy army, an enemy air force, you know, bombs your planes. They're history. They're gone. You get new ones. The Jews had nothing. They had so little that they were forced to reassemble the same destroyed planes from the pieces they had. And the pieces that they still need, they have to go and scavenge for a piece here for the plane here, a piece there for the plane there. It's unbelievable. And on top of that, to be able to come out victorious after all of that is a nace beyond imagination. Beyond imagination. So certainly even just the military nace is unbelievable. Just to think about it in terms of the sheer odds that were against the Jewish nation, it was incredible. And then if you read John Loftus and Mark Ahrens in their account of the behind the scenes events that led up to the vote in the UN in favor of partition in 1947, in November 29th, 1947. So if Amital writes in his sichot, he said in his sichot, he remembers as a youngster in Eretz Yisrael, as a teenager in Eretz Yisrael, you know, listening to the radio report on the day of the partition vote in the UN, and hearing the votes being counted out, yes, no, yes, no. And ultimately, and the concern was that Israel needed a two-thirds majority, excluding all abstentions. But of those who voted yes and no, there needed to be a two-thirds majority to approve partition. And the final count was 33 in favor, 13 against, and 10 abstentions. Okay, so certainly there was drama leading up to that, listening to the radio, the vote, yes, no, counting the votes. But what was remarkable and also beyond comprehension to anybody at that time, and certainly only miraculous now with the benefit of hindsight, was the fact that when you look at who voted in favor, so for the first time and perhaps the last time, the USSR and the US were on the same side of the page, more or less. The Soviets were supportive of the partition plan, which was a shock to everyone. And not only that, but in the last 3 days before the partition vote, eight Latin American and South American countries changed sides to favor Israel. Eight countries in the last 3 days changed sides to favor Israel. Which means that 3 days prior, Israel did not have the two-thirds majority that it needed. In the course of 3 days, miraculously, eight Central and Latin and South American countries, now these are the South American countries that were harboring Nazi war criminals, no great friends of the Jews, flipped their votes to favor Israel. Brazil, Haiti, Nicaragua, Bolivia, Ecuador, and even those countries that had initially voted no in prior Israel-Arab votes, Argentina, Colombia, and El Salvador, switched to abstention, to abstain. So, you know, to the person, regular observer at the time, this is just so strange, so incredibly amazing, with seemingly no explanation. And what these two authors, John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, suggest, I'm not a historian, so I can't offer a critical analysis of the merits of their research, but what they argue, based on their interviews that they conducted with numerous intelligence agencies and agents from that time, they make the fantastic case that during World War II, there was a small group of Jews headed by an Austrian Jew named Richard Kauder, who were working on behalf of Nazi military intelligence to save their own lives. They were acting as German spies who had information from agents on the inside of the Soviet military hierarchy, and they were feeding Soviet military plans and strategies to the Nazi Wehrmacht during the war, throughout the war. And what they claim in this book is that in reality, these Jewish Nazi agents were really communist double agents who were feeding the Nazis what the Soviets want them to hear. And apparently, after the war, the CIA, or at that time the OSS, not realizing that these were really communist double agents, thinking they were actually anti-Soviet German agents, brought some of these agents into the American intelligence system. And what this book claims Ben-Gurion did to get the Soviets to vote in favor of partition is that he went or sent someone to Stalin, to Russia, Stalin, and said to him, if you don't vote in favor of partition, we will expose all these communist double agents working within American intelligence. That's one claim that he has in this book. And all of a sudden, Stalin makes an about face. The Russian representative of the Union is all of a sudden very supportive of partition plan. He claims in the same book that Ben-Gurion and his intelligence agents had gathered a whole folder of incriminating evidence against Nelson Rockefeller, documenting his financial support of the Nazi government, his shipments of oil to Nazi Germany throughout the war, which is nothing less than treason for an American during a period of war against Nazi Germany. And they threatened him as well if he didn't use his influence with all the Latin and South American countries to turn their votes in favor of Israel, that they would publicize his misdeeds from the past few years during the war. And supposedly, it was in those 3 days after they met with Nelson Rockefeller that all these eight American, other Latin American and South American countries, all of a sudden, miraculously, switched their votes. So if this is true, just to stop for a moment and think how the Ribono Shel was able to coordinate way back into the 1940s, the beginning of the war, that there would be a small number of Jews who would be placed in such a manner during the war that they would have access to Nazi intelligence agents, Soviet intelligence, eventually American intelligence. They would have the information they needed to eventually play to their advantage a few years later, in 1947. This was all planned out initially, min ha-shamayim, to work out just this way, so that against all expectations, the UN vote would be in favor of Eretz Yisrael. It's pretty remarkable. And then within the U.S. State Department itself, U.S. government itself, Harry Truman recognized the State of Israel immediately after it was declared. But perhaps we often don't recall or don't think about is that the State Department was fiercely opposed to any recognition of the State of Israel, so much so that the Secretary of State told Truman, if you recognize the state, I will publicly oppose you in the next election. And against all this pressure and all of his State Department officials, Truman decided that he was going to, regardless, on his own, declare recognition of the State of Israel. Again, just how Kadosh Baruch Hu placed the right people in the right place at the right time, so that everything should work out the way he wanted to work out, is one of those nisim we should be appreciating when we look back at it now. Ron Lichtenstein points to Kapitel Chaf Beis in Tehillim. Lametzech ala yeles hashachar mizmor leDavid, which is a kapitel which David HaMelech speaks of Keli, Keli, lama zavtani, why have you left me, God? Rechuk mi shuasi, so far from saving me. Elokai akro yomam velosana, I call out daily and you don't answer. Laila, and at night, lo dumili, I have no rest. A kapitel that begins by describing Klal Yisrael in the midst of terrible tsaros with apparently no hope to be seen. And then the kapitel describes how Avosenu batchu v'tefalteima, but we trusted in you, you delivered us. Elecha zakuv v'nimotu, they cried out to you, they were rescued. Batchu v'lo boshu, they had trust, they were not shamed and embarrassed. And at the end of this kapitel, David HaMelech writes, Yavou v'yagidu tzirkaso l'am nolad ki asa. Yavou v'yagidu tzirkaso, that they will come and tell of God's righteousness. La'am nolad, to the newborn nation, ki asa, all of that which Kadosh Baruch Hu has done. And the Medrash on that Kapitel Tehillim says, what does that mean? Yavou v'yagidu tzirkaso la'am nolad ki asa, that they will come and describe his righteousness to the nation that has been born, all that he has done. Amar Rabbi Yudin says, Yavou doros ha'achronim, later generations will come, v'yagidu tzirkaso shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and they will describe the incredibly righteous kindness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, sha'asa l'doros harishonim, that he did for the earlier generations. And this, as Avraham Lichtenstein, is so fitting for Yom HaTzimut, when it was a time that Klal Yisrael was Ekra Yomam Velosana, going through a Beis HaKvaros of Tsaros, at every which way we looked, and not seeing the answers that we needed, not seeing the rescue right away, but having bitachon, being rescued as a result of our bitachon, the result has to be that we're Yavoh V'yagidu Tzidkaso La'am Nola Kiyasa, to describe not just to ourselves but to others, and especially to ourselves, the incredible acts of chesed that Kadosh Baruch Hu did for us to enable us to appreciate it. The Rav Zatzal, in a beautiful section of his essay, Kol Dodi Dofek, describes the events of Hakamas HaMedina as follows. Using the imagery of Shir HaShirim, which is the description of the intense love between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Klal Yisrael, we're in Shir HaShirim, Perek Gimel, Shlomo HaMelech writes, he describes, Al Mishkavi Balelos Bikashti Eis Shavan Afshi, by night I sought out the one who I have this incredible love for, bikashtiv lo mitzasiv, I haven't found him. Akumanov asovavo be'ir, let me get up, circle the city, bashvakim u'barchavos, in the marketplace, in the streets, avaksha isha avanavshi, bikashtiv lo mitzasiv, looking for God who I love so much, and I haven't been able to find him. And then in the next, two parakim later, parakei, Shlomo Melech writes, "Ha'ani yishenov li bi'er, I'm lying asleep, but my heart is awake. And all of a sudden, kol dodi dofek, I hear the sound of the one who I love knocking. Pischli achosi rayosi, please open the door for me." In essence, what this is a description of, says the Rav, is Klal Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. When we're in Saras, when we're in darkness, when we're in night, we look for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We're so desperate for that relationship, for the Eish She'ahava Nafshi. And then there are times when there's that opportunity that knocks on the door, the kol dodi dofek, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu reaches out to us. He comes out of that concealment in which he had been concealed in beforehand. He reaches out, extends the hand, knocks on our door, and says, "Please let me in. Let me inside." And Shlomo Melech describes how sometimes, so tragically, we waste the opportunity. Poshatati es kutanti echocha el bashana. I've already gotten undressed. How can I get dressed again? I've washed my feet, how can I get them dirty again? And Shlomo Melech says, and then eventually, I get up to open the door for him. I've opened the door, but he's left already. I start looking and calling, and I missed him. I can't find him anymore. And how so often throughout Jewish history there are times when Klal Yisrael is pining, yearning for HaKadosh Baruch Hu's close comfort. We don't see him. And then when he reaches out to us, we have to be sure not to waste the opportunity that's presented to us. And in the Rav's words, the entire process of HaKamas Medinas Yisrael is all about kol dodi dofek. It's all about God knocking on our door. This is an opportunity for us to react. Kadosh Baruch Hu, after the concealment of the war, of the Beis HaKavaris of the Holocaust, is reaching out to Klal Yisrael. It's our opportunity to say, this is the chance I have, having looked for so long through the Golus, for Eish Shahava Nafshi, this is now when God's knocking, and I've got to open the door before it's too late. And the Rav beautifully describes how the UN vote in favor of partition, as shocking as it was, that was a knock on the door. The incredible military victory, Rabin Biad Ma'atim, was another knock on our door. The fact that Bnei Yisrael once again are in control of Eretz Yisrael and even of Yerushalayim, which is a complete rebuttal of all that Christian theology stands for. Christian theology is all about the Jews are not the chosen people anymore. They are. The fact that we are once again back in control of Yerushalayim, of Har Bayis, of Eretz Yisrael, is a complete rebuttal of their claims that we don't have that Am Menuchah status anymore. That itself is a knock on the door. Kadosh Baruch Hu is showing us in the world that we are the Am Menuchah. The religious revival that's come about as a result of the inspiring events in Medinas Yisrael throughout the past six decades is another knock on the door. The fact that Jewish blood is no longer free for the taking, which is something that, if you think about it, HaKamas Medinas Yisrael really has changed people's perspective. I mean, Rosenzweig described this to me this morning. This was an incredible story. He said he remembers as a student in YU in 1948, HaKamas Medina was declared on Friday. He said the next day, Shabbos afternoon, after hostilities had broken out and the Arabs were attacking the Jews on all fronts, he said the boys in the dorm Shabbos afternoon looked outside and saw that the one building that yeshiva had at that time was all the main building, one building, Beis Medrash, yeshiva, dorm, was all in one building. The building was entirely surrounded by residents of the Heights. At that time, they were all Irish. And these Irish anti-Semites had surrounded the Yeshiva University building, and they were all screaming, "Kill the Jews." Can you believe this? Washington Heights in Manhattan, Irishmen, you don't usually associate them with Arab terrorism. Irishmen surrounded the Yeshiva University building, screaming, yelling, kill the Jews, kill the Jews. And the boys in Yeshiva, the Rosenzweig described to me, just sat inside and didn't do anything. They just waited it out. And eventually, after the passage of some time, the crowd dispersed. The next day, Sunday afternoon, in the evening, again, the exact same scene repeated itself. Irishmen surrounding the Yeshiva University building, yelling, chanting, screaming, kill the Jews, kill the Jews. It's shocking. And again, they just waited inside, doors locked, and waited till it passed. He said Monday morning, when for the first time the New York Times reported that the Haganah was gaining the upper hand in these military skirmishes in Eretz Yisrael, they didn't show up. 2 days in a row, they're all riled up. Kill the Jews, kill the Jews, kill the Jews. The deeply rooted anti-Semitism that was perhaps concealed for some time was just coming to the fore, because when the Jews were being attacked in Eretz Yisrael and were apparently on the losing end, so every anti-Semite across the globe got all excited, and it all came out. And the moment they saw that in Eretz Yisrael, the tide was turning, the tide was changing, for some strange reason, all of a sudden, they were too scared to come and show their faces. A very interesting story, which I think really just proves the point that the Rav was making, that with Hakamas Medinas Yisrael, people think twice about aggression against the Jewish people. It's a very interesting thought to ponder. But the Rav thought that was yet another knock on our door to wake up, so to speak. And finally, the fact that every Jew now has a place to go when they find themselves in a gullus that's a little too difficult to endure. The fact that Jews from the Middle Eastern countries were able to flee to Eretz Yisrael to avoid the oppression that they were suffering at the hands of their Muslim oppressors for so many centuries. The fact that now Jews in France, when anti-Semitism is ratcheted up a notch, can move to Eretz Yisrael en masse. The fact that we all have the opportunity to go to Eretz Yisrael when we want to is also, says Rav, a sixth knock on the door. Kol Dod Yidofek. And those knocks must be answered. And that ultimately is the achrayas responsibility we have in responding once again on Yom HaTzimut to the knocking on the door of Kol Dod Yidofek. And just to conclude with a couple of one or two brief thoughts. How to respond, what to do about those knocks. Obviously, those who are in a position to fulfill the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, that's the greatest response that one can muster to the Kol Dod Yidofek. But even if not, if Aaron Lichtenstein points to a beautiful Gemara Maseches Ksubas, Daf Ayin Hey Amud Aleph, where the Gemara says, Ulitzion Ye Amar Ish Ve'ish Yulad Ba, Pasuk in Tehillim Pei Zayin, which says that with regard to Yerushalayim, it shall be said, every man was born in her. And the Gemara is troubled. Every man was born in Yerushalayim? It's not true. So the Gemara says, what does that mean? That means is, Echad HaNolad Ba Ve'echad HaMetzapel Osa. Whether one is born in Yerushalayim or whether one lives a life of anticipation for the opportunity to go back to Yerushalayim, each of those individuals is Ish V'Ish Yulad Ba, is a Ben Yerushalayim, is a Ben Sion, so to speak. And the Gemara says, Abaye says, that one Jew who lives in Eretz Yisrael is worth two of us who live in Chutz La'aretz. And Rava adds, yes, but one Jew from Chutz La'aretz who goes to Eretz Yisrael is equivalent to two Jews living in Eretz Yisrael. What Rabbi Lichtenstein explained is that a Jew living in Eretz Yisrael is a Jew who's suffused with the Kedusha that Eretz Yisrael has to offer. He's a Jew who made Eretz Yisrael a reality in his own life. That certainly is an advantage that he has over us here in Chutz La'aretz. But at the same time, he runs the risk of taking it for granted after the passage of time. Whereas a Jew who lives in Chutz La'aretz, who lives with that anticipation, that yearning, that desire, that aspiration to go to Eretz Yisrael, has something perhaps that one in Eretz Yisrael doesn't have. He has that appreciation for the value of Eretz Yisrael. And therefore, if he's able to go to Eretz Yisrael and combines that appreciation for Eretz Yisrael with the actual living in Eretz Yisrael, that's worth more than anything else. And ultimately then, what is asked of us in response to the Kol Dodei Dofek is, if we're not yet zocha to live in Eretz Yisrael, at the very least, to be the other ish yulad ba, to be the one who is mitzapel l'rosa, to be the one who's constantly living that life, aspiring for the opportunity to go to Eretz Yisrael, so that when ultimately I do get there, that connection, that lifelong attachment that I've had to Eretz Yisrael will finally be realized in Eretz Yisrael, with an appreciation of Eretz Yisrael as well. We should all be zocha l'shana haba b'Yerushalayim.